Welcome back, everyone, to the Authentic As Fuck podcast. My name is Sun. I'm a storyteller and marketer. And in this podcast, I speak with entrepreneurs and creators, and we hear their stories and kind of try to figure out how their stories tie to who they are today. Today, we have Joanne Lee Molinaro. With over 5 million fans spread across all of her social media platforms, New York Times bestselling author Joanne Molinaro, aka the Korean Vegan, has appeared on the Food Network, CBS Saturday Morning, ABC's Live with Kelly and Ryan, The Today Show, PBS, and The Rich Roll podcast. She's been featured in the Los Angeles Times, The New York Post, The Atlantic, NPR, and CNN. And her debut cookbook was selected as one of the best cookbooks of 2021 by The New York Times and The New Yorker, among others. Welcome, Joanne. Hello.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Good seeing you again.
Yeah, so, it's definitely great seeing you.
Yeah, so like I said, like we want to know all about you, right? And we're like, our community is very interested in hearing stories and how a story defines a person. So what I want to do is, I do this with all of our guests and my clients as well. Let's start from the beginning. I want to know kind of how you grew up, your childhood, your upbringing, and let's start there.
Sure. So, yeah, I grew up in Chicago, the suburbs of Chicago. My parents immigrated to the United States in the early 70s, and I was born in 1979. And I was born in Chicago, Illinois, lived there for the first 4 years of my life in the city. And then my parents migrated to a suburb called Skokie, Illinois, which is, you know, maybe like 15 minutes drive from Chicago. And it was a very idyllic childhood. My grandmother lived with me pretty much the whole time. One of my grandmothers was living with me. So in the first few years of my life, my maternal grandmother, she lived with us and took care of me. And then when my brother was born, my little brother, he was the reason for my father's mother, my chinharmoni, to come from Korea and move in with us and take care of the kids. So I know my father was the oldest son. So when he had a son, it was a big deal to them. And she came. And I think because my grandmothers were always in my childhood, I had a very safe childhood. My parents were working a lot. My father worked for the post office and basically worked all night long. His shift started at, I think, like 2 a.m. and ended at 10. And then he would sleep all day, pretty much. So while we were awake, he was sleeping. And my mom was a nurse at the emergency room of a regional hospital. So she was working around the clock as well. And it was because my grandmother was, you know, cooking for us, taking care of us. You know, she was the one who played hide and seek with us. She was the one who played tag with us and taught us how to do the swings and, you know, all of those things that even though my parents weren't as present as I'm sure they wanted to be, I never felt like I didn't have a safe and very stable adult presence in my life. And that was basically it. Lived in Skokie for a long time. We moved to Wilmette, which is another northern suburb of Chicago. And yeah, it was a very nice childhood.
So were you closer with your grandmother than you are with your parents?
Probably, like during that time. Yeah. Like I think the way most people viewed their mom and dad, that is the way I viewed my grandma, my chinharmoni in particular, because my weharmoni, she moved out when I was 4 and my chinharmoni moved in and she was like the one who taught me to brush my teeth, how to tie my shoes, how to do all the things that you probably many people learn from their parents. She was the one who read to me when I was at night before going to sleep. She was the one who told me the story of the two sisters and the tiger and Cinderella and the boy who lived inside a peach. All of those stories came from my grandma. And, you know, of course, she was the one who yelled at me when I misbehaved. And so
you talked to her in Korea?
Oh, yeah. So Korean was my first language because of my grandmother's, because they didn't speak English. So I didn't speak Korean until I started going to kindergarten or English until I started going to kindergarten. And it was a little difficult because I literally knew no English. I just knew Korean.
Got it. So were you a good student? Like, how are you in school?
I think I was okay. I was very motivated because it was clear that my parents, like that was a really important thing. My dad only really paid attention to me if it had something to do with my grades or schooling. And my mom was like crazy. I mean, maybe it was typical, but I mean, it was like a personal indictment against her if I didn't do well in school. So it was like very ingrained in me that the best way to please your parents and to win your parents' love was to be good at school. So I was very motivated. It wasn't until my mother, she's a very avid reader. She's just a total book lover. I mean, she was reading Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Bronte when she was 10 years old. And so she, not in English, in Korean, but she introduced me to literature and books when I was very young, probably in fourth grade. And it was when I started reading a lot that you can see sort of my scholastic performance really skyrocket. So it was around fourth and fifth grade when my teachers started noticing Joanne's way ahead
what were you reading?
Of her peers. So it was a mix of literature and like the things that my mother shared. She tried to get me to read Dostoevsky when I was 10 and it was just like, no, I can't get into Crime and Punishment. Imagine. Sorry. I know.
You can't even get a high school kid to.
No, I know. She's like, well, I read this when I was 10. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't. But I did read like Bronte, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. Okay. And I was reading Anne of Green Gables. But I was also reading Sweet Valley Twins and Babysitter's Club and Ramona Brown, like all of those books. So it was just like a smattering of things that I love to read and that I think were a little bit more age appropriate and things that were challenging to me and really great at developing my imagination.
Mm. So kind of if you look back now, are there any kind of lessons that you think you took away from that period? Like, or did you notice that like your upbringing is, there's something different about your upbringing that's different than like maybe if your friends or other like people?
I think there are a couple of things. Number one, certainly now that I'm in this space that I'm in where I get to hear from so many people that I don't know who've had very different childhoods from mine, in particular, childhoods that were not safe, where they didn't have an anchoring adult presence in their life. That to me has really reinforced the importance of not taking for granted the fact that I had my grandmother's around. And, you know, even though my parents, you know, they were very typical Asian immigrant parents that were working around the clock and maybe weren't there physically as much, they never like made me feel like, you know, like unstable, you know? And that was really, really important. And I think that how lucky I am to have had those sort of roots in the beginning. I think the other thing is definitely my love of literature. And how early that started, that would not have happened if it wasn't for my mother. And, you know, my father was an English lit major, so he also loved to read, but it wasn't a passion. It was just like for scholastic purposes. Mm-hmm. For my mother, she would just fall into these stories. I mean, she could read forever and ever and ever. And that was so instantly developed when she started sharing that with me. And I honestly think, I mean, I've read thousands and thousands and thousands of books. And to me, it's like totally normal that's what I do. But now that I've kind of, you know, like my husband, like I think he's read like 5 books in the past like decade. You know what I mean? And where I can read 5 books in a week, that's something that I think was unique and I'm very grateful for.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say like, imagine your mom didn't introduce you to literature, like your whole life would be probably totally different now.
Totally different. Totally different.
So kind of growing up, did you have dreams? Like, did you know what you want to be when you grow up? Like, I know you went to law school. So like, how did that transition happen?
When I was little, I wanted to be a singer. Like that was just so, I was so determined that that was going to be my career. My family, especially my father, I should say my father's side of the family, has always had a deep appreciation for music. My father literally is listening to music almost around the clock. And he also, I think, fancies himself a singer. He loves karaoke. It's one of his favorite activities in the whole world. My Komo, which is my father's younger sister, she was actually a professional singer in Korea back in the day. So certainly singing is always something that's been a big part of our family. My grandmother, my chinhalmoni, she would sing to me every single night when it was time to go to sleep, and she would teach me all the Korean songs. And so at church, I was always the one that was like ushered up to the front, and you know, during Christmas holiday or service, and they would make me sing since I was like 2 years old. And there's like all these recordings of me when I was very young singing. And I think I always grew up thinking that's what I would ultimately do. But then of course, you know, when it was college application time and I needed to declare a major, my parents were like, what are you talking about? Like music? Are you kidding me? No, you can't do that. And, and you know, reality kind of hit very, very quickly when, you know, they were basically like, we're not going to pay for your college if you decide to major in music. Like you're basically on your own. And so I quickly shifted, I guess, away from a more artistic career.
And what was your like school life like? Like, were you popular? Like, were you hanging out with the Asian crowd, or like, what was the situation like there?
I think that yes, I did hang out with the Asian crowd, I think later in high school, but for the most part, I was sort of nerdy. I was never popular. It was hard to be popular, at least where I went to school, which is, you know, one of the wealthiest public schools in the country. Mm. Unless you were rich, like it was a little bit hard to be popular. And my parents were very, very blue collar. Like, yes, we had a home in one of the wealthier suburbs of Chicago, but it was like, it wasn't like the mansions that, you know, some of the kids at school like. And so it was, I was sort of nerdy, and I also loved to read, and I was sort of a bookworm, and I was in math club, I was in Model UN, I was in Latin club, you know, like all those things, I was in orchestra.
Okay, so you were like a good, good student, yeah.
I was a good student, I never did anything bad, I haven't even smoked a cigarette once in my entire life, I didn't drink, I was just a very good girl. I was also very involved at my church. And, you know, I spent most of my social life at church, like, you know, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturday, Sunday, I was at church with my Bible study group or my youth group.
Yeah, your life, the way you explain your life, it's like sounds almost identical to my life. It's the,
oh, everything really?
You're saying. Yeah, it's like so relatable. So, so you decided to. So at that moment, you decided to, okay, I'll go, since I can't major in music, I'll go to law.
No. So what ended up happening was I decided, okay, I'm just going to major in English. And after I get a degree in English, because I loved reading. I mean, that was directly a result of my mother. And I was like, okay, well, I'll major in English. I also loved to write. It wasn't, you know, that... I should say structured about my study of writing, but it was something that I did enjoy doing and that my teachers in high school had encouraged me because they were like, oh, you're a really talented writer. So I was like, okay, well, then I'll major in English because I love to read and I like to write. And then I'll get a teaching certificate afterwards and I'll just teach high school English. That's what I thought because my favorite teachers in school were my English teachers because that was my favorite subject in school. So that's what I thought I was going to do. And then I ended up graduating a year early from college because I did well enough on my AP exams to start as a sophomore.
Where did you go?
I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana. Champaign.
Oh, so it was close by.
It was close enough, yes. Oh. And I went there, and when I graduated, because I graduated a year early, I didn't plan very well for my future, and I kind of panicked. Like, I was like, oh my God, I don't have a job, and everyone else is getting jobs, and, you know, what am I going to do? And I was like, this stupid idea of getting a teaching certificate, what were you thinking? And so I just sort of panicked and I got a job as a resume writer because that was like the only job I could find at the time. And it was sort of a great job to have when you had no idea what you wanted to do with your future, because that's all I did like all day long was look at people's careers and write their resumes. So I had like this great opportunity to look, well, here are all the different kinds of jobs out there, right? And I had to write a resume for a lawyer one. That was one of my assignments one day. And I was like, oh, maybe I should be a lawyer. And that's literally how I chose law, because it was just sort of panic and anxiety and like, I just need to pick a job. And that just kind of happened to pop out at me.
Yeah. So would you say you're like a type A, kind of like very aggressive, that like a business person type of person? Or
I think not? I'm very goal oriented. Okay. You know, I'm very much like put a finish line in front of me. And then I become very determined and single-minded. Okay. I'm like, nothing's going to get in my way. But if I don't have a goal in front of me, then I get very anxious and uncomfortable. So a lot of my life, I think, is about struggling to set the appropriate goals to make sure that if I am going to adopt this sort of single-minded determination, it's directed at things that are effective in my life.
Got it. Yeah, because it doesn't sound like, because like I meet entrepreneurs who are like this person, ever since they were young, they were like kind of, you knew this person was going to, like they're like overachieve, like not over, because like, you know, there are a lot of overachievers in school that doesn't necessarily translate to career success.
Like, yeah,
they have a safe job maybe, but it's actually kind of, from what I've seen, it's the straight A students that usually are do a little better in entrepreneurship.
I completely worry about that sometimes, because, you know, right now I consider myself to be an entrepreneur, and sometimes I do feel like I have a very linear way of thinking instead of thinking out of the box or being a little bit more creative with problem solving, and also like being so risk averse that I'm unwilling to see the upside of taking a gamble in certain ways. And so sometimes I wonder like, okay, well, if I'm aware of that, can I do something to loosen some of the, you know, very uptight way of thinking that I have? Mm-hmm. And again, also making sure that the goal setting from the outset is very appropriate, because I know that's what motivates me.
Yeah. Is that something that you figure out later on in life, or is that something you've always known?
No, it's definitely something I figured out later on in life. I think what was
the story there? How did you real? Because that's like a very, that seems very perceptive. Do you know what I mean?
I think it was when I made partner at my law firm that I started to realize, whoa, okay, like you've literally done everything you wanted in your life. Like every box is now checked. Now what are you doing? You're only 30 something years old. Like you still have a long life to live. Like what's your next goal? And it was just that feeling of being so unmoored and almost lost when all of the moored, like unanchored, like I'm no longer tied to anything. Like I'm just kind of floating around, you know, without any direction.
No more goals.
Yeah, no more goals. And I'm like, I don't know what else to do with my life. I think that was when I realized that I had developed this real dependency on that mentality. And I really needed to do a little bit of inventory to figure out.
Mentality meaning like safety, that, like risk.
Yeah, adverse. Like. Yeah, just or more just like I have to have a goal. If I'm not pointed at something, then my life becomes very scary. And I was like, why is that? Like, why can't you just like, you know, figure it out or just spend some time floating around? There's nothing wrong with that. Why does everything have to be so linear? like there has to be this weird kind of taut tension between where you're at and where you're going, as opposed to taking it easy, looking around, observing, you know, and letting your vision go from this to this. And I think that was when I started realizing that. But also I was just like, I don't care. Like,
well, how long after you made partner, like how what does that process look like? How long did that take? Was it immediate or was it take a while? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I made partner, I was at the firm for like 10 years, I think. And I made partner, I made partner in 2015 and I started at the firm in 2004. So my 11th year there, I made partner. And like the first year you're just like, I love, you know, that I did this and it's amazing and I feel at the top of my career. And then after a year, you start realizing, okay, there's a lot of pressure attached to being a partner at a large law firm, pressures that didn't exist when you were a junior associate at a law firm. And geez, is this what my life is going to be like for the next 30 years? Like, I'm not sure that that sits very well with me. And it was at that point that I think a year after that I started really thinking like, is this what you want your life to be? Is this your future? And I think once I started giving myself permission to question that status quo, that's when there was this coexisting anxiety, like severe anxiety, almost like, you know how my parents were like, you can't major in music. It was that voice, that it's that same voice that was like, you cannot do anything to jeopardize your 401k, your steady paycheck, your good, safe job. But also this sort of kind of despair and a little bit of depression that I was now.
Let me ask you, do you think when you were hearing your mom's voice in your ear and you're like, I can't quit my job. Oh, wow. Right. How do you think your mom actually felt at that time? Do you think she would have been fine with you? Like, you've already made it. You've already made partner. Quit if you want to do whatever you want. Or do you think she still felt like,
oh no, she definitely felt like you can't quit your job. And I know this because when I told her I was quitting my job, she had a meltdown. So,
Okay. Yeah. So maybe she was literally speaking to you in your ear.
Yeah, no, it was, her voice is loud and clear. Like I knew it. Like it was very like clear, and I had internalized it. There's no question that like that so voice is also my voice. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so what? And also, I think it's super interesting that. Because you said once that thought has entered your mind, like you started getting anxiety. And a lot of times, like for me, that it happens like that too. I just realized like, because sometimes like I'm like, okay, one day I'll do something. But then some seed goes into your mind where I'm like, okay, I got to do this. And you start planning it out. And then now you're all of a sudden like you're obsessed with it. And like I think that something like that has to happen. Some sort of a seed has to be planted in your head that says, wait a minute. And then... obviously, you're not going to change overnight from there, but at least it's the seed starts growing in your head.
I think that's a really great analogy. It is a seed. And like when you think about a seed, like it's pushing its way out of the soil, right? There's like this disruption that's happening. And it's beautiful, absolutely, but it can also... you know, it causes pain. It's literally moving things out of the way and it's disrupting the status quo. And for me, again, being as risk averse as I am, that was like, I just remember like all the time being like, on the one hand, oh my God, there's a potential that this, you know, the seed is going to grow and break through the soil and feel the air and oxygen and all of those things, the sunlight, you know, and that was exhilarating and intoxicating. But on the other hand, it was terrifying and scary. And so there were always these two competing feelings of like, no, 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 no. And then like, but what if, you know, and at a certain point, the what if eventually overruled the fear.
How did that happen? Was that like a slow process? Because I'm sure this is the same exact thing that a lot of people are going through, right? They have the fear is greater than their desire. And so what was that process like?
I think there are a couple of things. I think that there's the practical aspect to it, because I'm a big believer in, like, there always has to be a practical sort of understanding and mechanism in place in order to facilitate that kind of transition. There's some people who are like, no, it was all about my dream and my passion. And I'm like, okay, you go for it. Yeah, but I'm not like that. Like, I need a path. And I think the path became revealed itself to me, I guess, when I started, you know, I started The Korean Vegan, which is totally just a blog, you know, veganizing Korean food in 2016. And I'd been doing it for about a year and a half when I was approached for a book deal. And I signed with one of the largest publishing houses in the world, Penguin Random House. It was one of my favorite publishers, I mean, when I was growing up, right? So to me, that was such an indication that maybe there is something viable out of this brand that I've created, notwithstanding the fact that it was just a hobby. It wasn't designed to be a source of money. It was just like something fun. And I think so that was a very important thing for me, because it signaled, okay, notwithstanding your fear, there is maybe something out there that you could pursue as a source of revenue if you decide ever that the law is no longer your career. I think that was really important. I think the other moment that I really very vividly remember, and I talk about this a lot, was I was listening to a podcast episode. It was a ritual podcast episode, and it was with this man named David Epstein. He'd written this book called Range, which, you know, is very, I think at that time, very important to me. And he talks about how some of the people who are now known to be the best at what they do didn't actually step into that role until their mid-30s, 40s, or even 50s. And it was because they had given themselves permission to fail at all the previous iterations of who they were. And it was through this sort of beautiful tableau of failure that was uniquely attached to them, almost like their failure DNA, that allowed them to succeed at that level a little bit later in life. And when I read that and heard that in that podcast, I just remember feeling, again, that really almost like physical tension between the fear and the hope of liberation. And I think it was like, that was the first time in my life where I almost started to cry. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm allowed, even at this age, to still have a dream and to still pursue that dream. It's not too late. And it was scary, but I remember at that moment, the potential for liberation was so much more powerful than my fear.
Mm-hmm. It sounds also kind of like, by the way, that's beautiful what you said about the range thing. It's because those are the years that most people feel like, oh, I don't want to waste time, so I got to make the right decision, pick the right major, and right. But that book is basically saying, yeah, you should go ahead and waste time because all of that is going to add up later in your life, right? So one thing that I keep hearing over and over is, do you feel like anything new you do, you somehow need from someone like a permission to go ahead and proceed with this? Like, do you understand what I mean?
I do.
And I feel this with clients. I'm not saying that's like, I get this with clients who's built multiple $100 million businesses. And it's almost like they come to me and ask for my permission to run this marketing. I'm like, what? And I feel a little bit of that, yeah.
I think I think permission is an interesting word. I do sometimes worry that I seek counsel from too many people and too often. Mm-hmm. And I don't have sufficient conviction in my own judgment. And you know, to some degree, I do think that being open to good counsel, Being open to mentorship is a key component of success. However, I think at a certain point, it can become a crutch and it can prevent you from really learning what it means to be confident. And I think that's where I sometimes have a problem is that, you know, I got to ask everybody, like, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? What do you think about, how about this? You know, instead of just, you know, ask, I think it's fine to ask your one or two people. Like if it's your business partner, you probably should ask them, you know, or if you have a business mentor, that's what they're there to do. But sometimes I feel like I literally ask everyone instead of simply saying, okay, actually you have more expertise in this than the people that you're asking. At a certain point, you have to just learn to be confident in your choices and also realize that, okay, if you make the wrong decision, it's not the end of the world. You have to be confident that notwithstanding that wrong decision, you will get back up and you'll figure it out.
How does it work in the world of law? Like, is it like very tight like that? Or is it kind of like, okay, like, okay, maybe this won't work out, but let's try it. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's no...
Because it sounds like you need... it almost seems like from what you're saying, like you need to collect almost like overabundance of information before you can make a decision.
That is so true.
And it's, and maybe it's a fear of making the wrong decision. You want to be like 100% sure. But what I found with a lot of entrepreneurs from my experience is that a lot of them make 50-50 decisions. And like they take very, like, they're very risky. Like I was shocked actually. And, you know, they're, yeah.
I think that is interesting. I never really thought of it that way. But as a lawyer, you are literally gaming everything out to the point where you not just predict how things are going to end up, but then have a plan to deal with the thing like that happens. Yeah. Like that is
every
the way
case
that
scenario.
You, every case scenario. Exactly. I mean, my job, literally, sometimes I would have spreadsheets that would game out every single potential outcome, the likelihood in percentage points of that that outcome, and then multiply that by the financial consequence of that outcome so that I could tell my clients, this is going to, this choice will cost you this much. This choice will cost you this much. This choice will cost you. And so like that was sort of how I arranged so much of my counsel. My counsel was never going to be, my advice to my client would never be, well, you could just try this and see what happens. Like that's never, it was like, if the chances of XYZ happening, if you do this are this, and this is the consequence of that. And this is the plan we have in place to deal with that. So it was always like thinking 20 chess moves ahead, as opposed to like, oh, I'll just make this move and just, you know, let's see what
and
happens.
And that's probably what made you a good attorney. So that's not like, it's not really a weakness in my opinion, I think.
Well, and certainly it, not in law. Yeah.
I also think in business, it's not a weakness. Because like the way I see it is like everybody's weakness is they don't realize that it's actually their strength. So they try to fix it. They're like, oh, that's my weakness. So I need to fix it. But I don't think that's actually a good move because then you're actually suppressing your biggest strength.
Your asset. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like though, because I actually think that does apply to business because cause it sounds like you're, oh, let me first ask you this. So right now, so you made partner, you're like, okay, a goal achieved. Now what, right? That you were in that place. So now you wrote a book, New York Times bestseller, you know, biggest published, like your dream publisher from when you were those childhood reading days, right? Now you literally, your dream has come true. Do you feel a little bit of that again that you felt?
You know, that's a really great question. And I'm sure you've heard of this, you know, phrase, the moving goalposts. And, you know, I actually was reading Atomic Habits, like right around the time that my, you know, book was launched. And, you know, and he talks a lot about how it's, you know, goals are important, but as important, and sometimes even more important, is learning to enjoy the process of getting to that goal. If you put all your eggs in the goal and you lose sight of the process, then that almost cheapens the goal, right? Like in doing that. And so like, you know, I remember reading that and then, you know, my book hits the New York Times bestsellers list and like all this stuff is happening. And I remember I let myself enjoy that moment for about 24 hours. Like I cried, I, you know, went out to a nice fancy dinner with my family and, you know, we were like, I can eat as much as I want because I'm a New York Times bestseller today. You know, I had like lots of pizza and lasagna and all that stuff. Right. And then like the next day I was like, okay, what's next? What do we have to do now? I'm, you know, I had just withdrew from partnership because I withdrew from partnership the same month that my book came out. So I was no longer tied to the firm. Like, I was like, okay, what's next? What do we have to do now? And so it was just like, I didn't give myself a lot of time to enjoy crossing that finish line. It was more just like, okay, now I need to figure out my next race. And it's that constant sort of thing. And, you know, people say, you probably hear this all the time, like it's important to enjoy your, you know, milestones and blah, 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 all that stuff. And I'm like, okay, I guess I believe that in theory, but that's not something I'm terribly interested in practicing. You know, I'm much more interested in making sure that the goals that I'm setting for myself are appropriate and effective for me, and that I'm doing the things necessary to achieve those goals. So that's kind of the mentality that I had. And there was a time when I felt a little bit like maybe I should rethink that. And now I'm just like, no, I like being goal oriented.
No, that's actually what I was going to say is, I'll talk about that. How did your weakness is actually your strength. But so it sounds like you had this fear of uncertainty, and then it kind of hit you like right after you made partner. But then the second time around, it didn't hit you as hard. You kind of like learned your lesson from the, I guess, previous go around. You're like, oh, I just focus on the process of enjoying this, writing this blog, and this is the result it came. So I know that I just have to set another goal and enjoy that process or whatever. Something like that. Is that what happened?
I think it was more just, at that time, it was my first time without a steady paycheck. It was my first time really having to learn what it meant to be a business person. And I know that being a content creator and a full-time content creator is not exactly the same thing as, you know, a solo entrepreneur. It's a little bit different. It's more like kind of contractor or freelancer, I feel like, in a lot of ways. But I really forced myself to view it as, you are now starting your own business. It's called Joanne Molinaro LLC, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, like that, this is you now. You're on deck. And I was galvanized at that time to sort of approach it the same way that I approached my legal career. Like when I started at the law firm, I mean, I was your typical annoying person where I was like, I'm going to be the best. Like, you know, there's a class of 12 of us. I want my name to be at the top of this list. That was always my mentality. If somebody says they're going to get it done at 8, I'll get it done at 6. You know, if someone says they're going to work 12 hours, I will sleep on the floor. Like that was sort of my mentality. And it was the same thing when, you know, October rolled around, my book comes out, it does really, really well. I was like, okay, well, now it's time to go on tour. And I'm going to kick the shit out of this tour. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be the best at this. And I really think I was. Like my publisher was like extremely overjoyed with how engaged I was and how much I was doing. And then come 2022, right? My book comes out in 2021. The tour is pretty much over because of COVID. Like Omicron was like going crazy and like nobody was like doing in-person stuff anymore. And so I had to really sit down. And again, I was very much determined to view the Korean Vegan as a business. So I literally sat down and I spent the month of January developing a business plan and a business strategy and outlining a mission statement, all of those things. I had this massive spreadsheet where I had all these little mini goals designed to effectuate the larger goal of turning the Korean Vegan into an enterprise. And that was really terrifying because I had no idea what
was that doing. Something that you made a decision after the book came out and it did well, or were you leading up to that? Were you already kind of planning, okay, I should do something with my own brand?
No, it was leading up to that. So I made the decision to withdraw from partnership at the firm in probably like June. So about 4 months before my book came out. And that was in large part because, you know, the year before I had started a TikTok and my TikTok account was blowing up and, you know, I was getting requests for speaking engagements and cooking demos. And so I already was, again, remember how I talked about this path revealed itself to me when I, you know, signed the book deal in 2018. Well, that path became more and more tangible to me. It was just, you know, at first it was like this hazy little mirage, you know, and then I could literally see the bricks being laid down on that path in 2020 and 2021. So that by the summer of 2021, I was like, well, this path is as real as the one that I'm walking on. So I'm comfortable now letting go of my legal career and shifting to this path. So I already knew by the time my book came out that this was something that I was investing in full time.
So you had a project ready to go.
Yes.
So do you, where do you think your sense of like the risk adversity or that sense of safety comes from? Is it financial or is it like nothing to do with finance? Like, why do you feel like you need...
It's all to do with money. And that I get from my mom and my dad. Like I just, cause I struggled with this a lot. I started to wonder like why I was so obsessed with being the best. And particularly as it surrounded comparing myself to my peers, I'm always comparing myself to people around me, particularly Asian women. And I think eventually I realized that it was because of this sort of scarcity mentality. Like I constantly believe there's only crumbs left for us. So if you are not going after those crumbs with every last inch of your reserve, then you're going to be left off the table.
Like it's
you're
like not a very competitive. Anything. Yeah.
Very competitive. Very competitive. And I really... Yeah. I hated that about myself. I thought it was really disgusting. And I was like, because what it does is it can sometimes make you mean to the people who you should be the most supportive of, your peers, right? And I hated that. I thought it was so ugly. And so I really did some investigation about that. And I concluded that it was because my parents, understandably, had a scarcity mentality because they literally were homeless and starving and, you know, for so much of their lives. And so financial security for them was like the most important thing. And I internalized that without even realizing it. So I feel like whether it's crass or crude or whatever, like so much of what I do is motivated by being financially secure, like too much, I feel like. And, you know,
and
I'm lucky I have my
husband
who... Yeah.
So when did you realize that I don't want to be like this, that I'm sometimes being mean, like, and then how did you overcome that?
Well, I think that I started realizing that when I started blowing up a lot on TikTok, because I was like, you know, social media is so weird because you can see like how, quote, well your peers are doing, like literally the numbers, like, oh, my video has 50,000 views. Their video has 5 million views. Like the grades are like, you know how like in Korea, like they publish everybody's grades and ranking, like, you know, like on the outside of the school building. And you know, you can see how everybody else is doing. And I feel like that's a little bit like social media, like everybody's grades are published for the whole world to see. And so it just became very easy to believe that, oh yeah, so they're doing better than me because look at their views, look at their metrics. And then the competitive spirit just became very ugly. And I could sense that. I never like tried to sabotage anyone or anything like that. It wasn't like I did anything, but it was just like an ugly feeling and I hated it. And that was when I really had to do some digging and figure out, well, why do you feel this way? And, you know, like I said, I figured that it was, you know, something I had internalized, an anxiety I'd internalized from my parents. And once I realized that, then it became much easier to deal with that. And my solution, anytime I feel even a little bit of like competitiveness towards any of my peers, is to just befriend them. And just become really, really good friends with them, because then I can't feel anything negative about them. Then their successes are things that I am excited about, as opposed to things that I hate.
Yeah, that's such a great lesson. I also feel like when I meet people that are like long-term successful, they all have they have humility. They're very kind, and they're like very supportive, and they're not very competitive actually. Like they might be competitive, but in a very friendly way, right? So that's amazing that you recognize that about yourself and you worked on it. And I also agree with the maybe it's like a Korean household thing, or maybe it's like this generation, but I also grew up with that same mentality. And I feel like even if for Koreans, even if they're doing well, like let's say they're not poor or something like that, there's still that like what's mine, like there's still that little bit of envy towards your neighbors, like I need to do better, like my son needs to go to a better school than your son, and like there's still that nature, and you see that growing up, you see how your parents are with your friends, and I just think you pick it up, and that maybe became part of me too, and I because I went through the same thing you went through, and I really like I had to really work on my ego. I think it's the biggest lesson I learned through running a business is how to control my ego.
Yeah, I think controlling ego is also something that, as a social media person, that is something you have to figure out pretty quickly. Because if you can't control your ego, it will eventually come back to harm you. Because then you start attaching your value to so many things that are actually inaccurate and incomplete measures of value at best. And so you start looking at yourself through this very distorted lens, and eventually you completely become detached from your own worth. And it's a very scary thing. And I always go back to the question of what's effective. That to me is like the most important question in the entire world. What is effective? And sometimes letting your ego get in the way is very, very ineffective when it comes to trying to achieve your business goals.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. And I think Koreans are especially bad at that. Like I remember like growing up, going to church, like literally Koreans go to church to like show off their car and show off their wealth. And like, it's kind of not pretty. But I was going to say, like, I think your weakness is actually your strength in a way that we think that, oh, yeah, like everyone, all these entrepreneurs took huge risks. And there are like people like Elon Musk who does that, right? Steve Jobs, maybe things like that. But what we forget is actually majority of the entrepreneurs are not like that. They take very calculated risks. And I actually think that your weakness is your strength. I think it is the reason why you made partner probably at such a young age and things like that, because you didn't take any unnecessary risks. And obviously there's like hard work and all of that too. But I love what you said about how by the time you left your law firm job, partnership, this other thing was already set up and ready to go. And there's very little risk there, right? Because you kind of like naturally let this happen already, and then you jump ship. So I actually think that people can learn from that. I wish people can, like, because I see some entrepreneurs that are just making some really ridiculous, unnecessary risk. And I actually think that... Go ahead.
I mean, I think what you're saying is like unnecessary risk. That's like a very important adjective when it comes to risks. Like some risks are necessary. Some risks may be necessary, may not be necessary, but there are some risks that are just not necessary. Like you don't need to do it that way. And, you know, I always tell people, if you want to give your dreams the biggest chance at success, the most important thing you could do is give it time. The shorter the runway, the less likely your dream is going to take off. And the most important thing you can do for your runway is to put some money in the bank. Make sure you've got a plan B, C, D, and E. Like, figure out, like, what are the things you're going to do to make money? Figure out, like, what are your expenses going to actually look like? I mean, these are things that, like you said, like, you can do. Like, if they're not impossible. Sure, maybe, like, putting a lot of money in the bank, depending on your situation. I don't know how possible that is, but it is absolutely possible for you to, you know, pull up your Excel spreadsheet out and figure out, these are my expenses on a monthly basis. This is my projected income on a monthly basis. Does this even look like it's going to work? And if it doesn't, well, then maybe I need a little bit more time. You know, so, like, these are things that I think anybody can do. And, you know, the romanticization of dream chasing and all of that stuff, okay, that's great. It's inspiring. It can maybe motivate someone, nudge them out the door. But to me, I was like, that, I'm fine with that. I already have all that. I need a plan. I need something that actually will keep me on this runway long enough for my dream to take off.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Like, most entrepreneurs that I talk to that are struggling with, like, raising prices or, like, their cash flow and things like that, when I talk to them, it's like they don't have financial stability. So they're making, like, desperate decisions, which is hurting their business. So I always tell them, save money first, come back a year later. It's not too late. You can, and I think that's an important message, actually, right? That a lot of young people don't want to hear, but it's actually an important message. Like, what a young person would do right now, I think, is they would quit their job, try to find a publisher to publish their book without anything. Whereas in you did zero of that, right? You reduced all the risks by doing it the way you did. And I think that's such a smart move, you know?
It's also like a, like, to me, like, I mean, doesn't that give you a permission again? Like, you don't need to have it all figured out right now. Like, it's not do or die. You know, you can take your time to figure it out. And, like, sometimes that's exactly what you need is, you know, I didn't monetize the Korean Vegan. I started in 2016. I didn't actually monetize it until 2021. So, like, it was 5 years of just, like, it being a hobby and learning and figuring out what works and seeing what's available and what are the opportunities. Like, I mean, like, who wants to have a homework assignment that's due tomorrow? I mean, everybody's favorite homework assignment is the one that, you know, you get several months to really perfect it and hand it in when you're comfortable. I mean, I think that's one of the nice things about this was that I never felt pressure like, oh, I have to do this tomorrow. It was more just like, I'll just do it when I feel ready.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that there's probably a lot of risk-averse people that are, like, afraid of those kind of risks that probably needs to hear this and take their time and build their business slowly. kind of like to wrap things up. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, so let's kind of try to, I'm sure there's a lot of things in your life story that we haven't went over, but if you wanted to kind of say, here's, like, the biggest myth that I think people are believing. And, like, if you were to say, here's what I want to do for the world. Like, here's the myth that I want to break in the world, or here's the change that I want to make in the world. Like, what would you say that would be? What would that message be?
Oh, geez, that's a tough one.
Or, like, even it can be a few. Like, and think of, I think you can think of it as, like, from the life lessons you've learned, because I'm sure there are areas in your life you're like, oh man, I thought the world was like this. But actually, no, it's actually, you know, I got to take more risk or whatever, right? Things like that. Like,
I think, yeah, I mean,
key lessons.
I think one thing is, like, one myth that I'm continuously dismantling for myself is that, like, there's a picture perfect ending to everything. I think because we watch movies and, you know, television shows and we hear about all of the success stories that, oh, as long as you just work really, really hard and do it, like, you're going to be that success story too. It's almost like if you love this guy and you want to be with him, you'll go through 2 hours of silliness and eventually you guys will end up together. Like, there, it's just like, you know, we kind of know intellectually that that's not real, but then there's this sort of almost instinct in us to believe that that's real, like that there's always this picture perfect ending at the end of the rainbow, right? And I think what I continue to learn is nobody's going to hand you anything. You really need to be in charge of your own destiny, okay? Like, failure, success, winning, losing, like, those are all going to be part of your journey. And the most important thing isn't whether or not you're going to win or lose, but who you're going to be when you are winning and losing. Like, who's that person that's going to show up, you know, at those finish lines, at the valley, on top of the mountain? Because those are all ups and downs are inevitable. But the only thing you can really control is who you're going to be in those moments. And that's like something I keep going back to. And it's also, it's like a source of challenge to me, like, okay, this is the challenge, but it's also a source of immense comfort to me, because it's like almost takes the pressure off of, like, you have to satisfy everyone else's expectations. And instead, I get to just focus on, okay, who am I and who is Joanne at every moment in this journey?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's, it's very, very close to kind of the conclusion that I came to for my own life philosophy is, yeah, it's not about like winning or losing. It's about how I play the game. Mm-hmm. and I try to play my game all in, whatever is in front of me. And it sounds like you have very similar, like, once you have a goal, you're going to do it all out.
Yes.
Like, you're gonna... And yeah, I love that. And anything else, any other profound, like, life lessons or things that you wish your audience would understand? Like,
I think the other thing that I'm also learning these days is that suffering for suffering's sake is stupid. And I think that is it's very stupid. And I think it's hard because I grew up as a Korean Christian woman, you know, like, suffering is our inheritance. You know, it's, you know, like, we brag
about
our
suffering. It's like a
badge
of honor. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like, why are you doing this? Like, you don't need to suffer. Like, and I think that sometimes, like, when I was toiling away at my job, I almost was like, well, that's how I know that I'm a good person, is because I hate my job. And I was like, okay, like, but if you don't have to hate your job, like, why are you doing it? Like, I always say this to young people, spend less time, you know, thinking about your fear, and spend more time thinking about what brings you joy. I'm not saying that you shouldn't spend any time about the things that bring you fear. Those are the things you want to mitigate against and protect against. But sometimes we do so at the expense of the things that actually make us laugh and make us smile and you know, gives us that beautiful bubbling feeling inside of our stomach that makes us look at the world and say, I'm so happy. I'm so happy to be alive. I mean, how many moments do you get like that in your life? Maybe you can have more of them if you would just give yourself permission to do that. And so I sometimes, like, that's an important message that I wish more people believed. I just don't know that many people believe that anymore. And I know life is hard. It's really difficult right now for many people, but I don't want them to lose sight of that.
Yeah, I love that. Like, I agree with you. I feel like almost everybody's kind of playing not to lose rather than playing
exactly
to win.
Yeah.
And I guess you kind of had that, the confidence boost came for you through your life experience. There are still a lot of people out there who hasn't had that yet. And just from listening to your story here, what I'm taking away is, like, you have this kind of gift of actually being risk averse. and you're more risk averse than probably most people. So all these people who are scared to, you know, do that thing that they want to do, and they're just kind of all scarcity mindset. I'm like, I'm just playing not to get fired. I'm just playing just enough so I can pay the rent this month. Like that mentality person, you can, I almost feel like you're kind of like a hope for, okay, you can be like that. You can be risk averse and still take chances and still go after the things you want. Like you don't have, it doesn't mean you have to like go live on the streets and risk everything. Like,
well, I think that's true, but I also think, and you and I have talked about this offline, which is one of the key assets though that I had was a person who believed in me, even when I wasn't willing to believe in myself, and that was my husband. And I do think that not everybody's lucky, and not everybody gets to have that kind of person in their life. I was incredibly lucky that my husband, who's an artist and who maybe has a more tolerance for risk than I would, was willing to be that champion for me in those kind of dark, really scary moments, and say to me, "You're extraordinary. I believe in you. And even if everything fails, we'll always have each other. And that's enough."
Yeah, that's definitely a huge sense of security if you have that. Like, so.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually think that's why I love working with business partners, and you know, you go through those ups and downs together.
So, makes it more fun.
Yeah. And I think I have also went through that. There was like a period in my life when I was kind of, when I first started my business, we're basically paycheck to paycheck, right? We're just trying to meet payroll and things like that. And I was taking on projects that I shouldn't have, red flag clients and things, just because I was desperate for the cash. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't later until like Gigi took over the finances and like we actually had a surplus. That's when I started making better decisions. And that's when I actually started having fun and not working out of fear. And I think everybody needs to kind of have that experience once.
Yes. And also everybody needs a Gigi. I wish she could take over my finances.
That's true. I got so lucky.
Exactly.
Yeah. Definitely like don't go through it alone. If you can find somebody who can, you know, you can lean on, ask for help.
Exactly.
Is there anything you want to kind of, any last message you want to tell the audience? And also, is there anything that you're promoting right now? Anything that where can people find you?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been a really great conversation. It's been very fun. And, you know, I've loved your podcast. I love your work. And I think your story is so amazing. And I really can't wait for you to write it in a memoir one day that I could read. But otherwise, yes, one day. You know, you can find me at The Korean Vegan pretty much anywhere, on the websites, on all the social media platforms. And that's about it.
Yeah, definitely check out her socials. Go buy her book. I'll put all the links on the show notes. Thank you so much for coming today. Thank you so much for being open and honest and sharing your story. And hopefully you can come back and fill in the rest of your story for us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Joanne. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Cheers.